From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Melissa Block. To be or not to be modern? That was the question in 1984 in a British TV series called Playing Shakespeare. It featured a group of stage actors in master classes showing how to blend Elizabethan and modern techniques. Only one of the performers then was a familiar face, Ben Kingsley, who had just made the film Gandhi. But as Bob Mondello discovered while watching the 25th anniversary DVD of Playing Shakespeare, some of those faces are instantly recognizable now.
The co-founder of London's Royal Shakespeare Company is running the show, but you'll find yourself looking at the performers sitting behind him. There's Gandhi in a sports shirt, and Agatha Christie's Inspector Poirot, younger and slenderer than you remember him. Captain Picard seems to have beamed down from an unpaid internship on the Starship Enterprise, and they're all watching a whiskerless, barely out of his 30s, Gandalf, as he's asked to work a little interpretive magic with the opening line of The Merchant of Venice.
In sooth, I know not why I am so sad.
Now, that simple line can be said in an infinite number of ways. Try it sadly.
In sooth, I know not why I am so sad.
Now try and ask what is Antonio's intention. Perhaps it's to try to explain himself.
In sooth, I know not why I am so sad.
And one more. Try and put an end to the conversation.
In sooth, I know not why I am so sad.
So on.
Ian McKellen is now a familiar movie face from Lord of the Rings, but as he was reciting that one line over and over, he was just a young classical actor starting to make a name for himself on stage. So was Judi Dench, back before she was 007's boss M. Here she's experimenting with a giggly line reading for a part where she's in breeches, not a skirt.
My father had a daughter, loved a man. As it might be, perhaps, were I a woman, I should, your lordship.
Also on hand is Patrick Stewart, already bald, and to my taste, a little too baldly declamatory in Henry V.
Why do you stay so long, my lords of France? Big Mars seems bankrupt in their beggared host, and faintly through a rusty beaver peeps.
Through a what? What on earth is he talking about? But you can sort of hear why producers thought he was spacey enough to command a starship. None of these folks is a kid, exactly. They were among the RSC's leading players at the time, old enough to know their way around a soliloquy. So it's fun to hear them talking about verse and vowels and how pronunciation helps to propel ideas. That will naturally be of most interest to actors, but there's something compelling, too, in hearing these folks place what they do in a historical perspective. Ian McKellen, for instance, arguing that it might simply not be true that modern actors are more natural than the grander performers of yesteryear. Actors, he says, are always trying to be natural. It's just that natural meant something different in the 19th century.
Everything about the world seemed to be certain. The British Empire was there and was going to last for 1,000 years, and therefore Henry Irving could stand firmly on a stage with 3,000 people and make declarations. And that was the nature of life which he could find within Shakespeare. We, with our different perceptions of the world, the fact that life is difficult, ambiguous, complicated, the British Empire doesn't exist anymore, and what is our role as a nation in the world, what is our role as people, as parents, as children, tends to direct our attention into the detail.
That is a nifty historical argument, and one that applies equally well to politicians and preachers and, dare I say it, folks who chat you up on the radio. Playing Shakespeare is, in fact, more than just a lesson in acting. It's a lesson in how the Bard of Avon knew, and all sorts of folks have since learned, that the best way to persuade is to hold the mirror up to nature. I'm Bob Mondello.
You may have heard about the case of the disappearing e-books, and we're not talking about a new Nancy Drew novel. The online retailer Amazon deleted some of George Orwell's books from its Kindle readers after it discovered that the books had come from an unauthorized reseller. Orwell lovers were not happy about the Orwellian solution.
I saw the story about Amazon removing George Orwell books from people's Kindles, and 1984 was the last book that I was reading. So I went upstairs, turned my Kindle on. Within a few seconds, the screen refreshed, and it was completely gone from my device.
That was Justin Goronsky, a 17-year-old high school student in Michigan. He's suing Amazon over the deletion of his book. To find out more about Justin's case, go to npr.org/soapbox and read the latest from Queen Akim and cyberfrequencies.com, a website and podcast devoted to stories that are buzzing on the web. It's all part of Maker's Quest, a project of the Association of Independents in Radio and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
The movie Slumdog Millionaire was a surprise hit in the United States, and it introduced many Americans to Indian-style cinema. This was not an opportunity the entertainment industry was going to waste. Tonight, more Bollywood comes to America with a miniseries on the independent film channel called Bollywood Hero. The former Saturday Night Live performer Chris Kattan plays himself, leaving Hollywood for Bollywood because he's offered a chance to be a leading man. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Chris Kattan says Bollywood movies make him remember why he wanted to be a movie actor.
I had that dream of wanting to be in the movies that we used to make, you know, those great MGM musicals and those great action films, and when movies were an escape and really, really pure entertainment. And Bollywood makes those kind of films.
Perhaps with a nod to his own frustrations, Kattan plays an actor who wants to break out of comedic roles. The series opens at a party where Kattan runs into his agent, who's trying to convince him how lucky he is to get a role in a sci-fi series.
He's the second male alien lead on a budding cable network TV show that I'm guessing is consistently going to rank in the top 75, give or take 25.
I say congratulations.
Look, I don't want to play an alien, all right? Why can't I go out for the roles that, like, Keanu gets, huh? Why can't I do that?
Kattan snaps back that he's been offered a leading role in India.
You're going to play cowboy?
No, it's not that kind of Indian. From India, like the country.
When Kattan actually arrives in India, he's surprised to find the industry there is more sophisticated than even he imagined. He goes on a tour of Bollywood studios with his director, Monty Kapoor, played by actor Ali Fazal.
This is really impressive. This is much bigger than any set I've ever seen in L.A.
Well, Steven Spielberg needed financing for his latest deal. Where do you think he came?
Spielberg, you know, I met him twice.
This is, in fact, accurate. There's a huge amount of money in India.
Priya Joshi is a professor at Temple University who's writing a book on Bollywood cinema.
So when Monty proudly says when Spielberg needed money for his two big ventures, he came to us. Indeed, that's the case. $500 million has just been poured into a DreamWorks co-production. And the idea is that Hollywood would make the movies, Bollywood would fund them.
But Indians may not be bringing just the money. Every year around the world, more people buy tickets to see Indian films than American movies. Debbie DeMontro, who gave the green light to Bollywood Hero at the Independent Film Channel, thinks Americans will enjoy the series because it mixes a little East and a little West.
Because you're telling it through the eyes of an American character, and specifically Chris Kattan, who's playing himself, and someone who, you know, American audiences are very familiar with, I think it's a really nice mix of just an American story and an introduction to a different type of cinema.
And in that Bollywood type of cinema, the actors find reasons to break out into elaborate dance numbers decked out in glitzy, bright costumes.
Would you like to dance?
Now?
Yeah, now.
In Bollywood Hero and in real life, Kattan struggled to learn Indian dance, but eventually he proves to a Bollywood starlet, played by Neha Dupia, that he can do it, albeit with a little American disco twist. But Professor Priya Joshi worries that Bollywood Hero may be missing something important about Indian cinema.
Some Western viewers, perhaps most, look at the cinema and say it's a cinema of energy, it's a cinema that's very dynamic, it's a cinema of song and dance, I'm going to go for that. And they miss the point that the songs and dances are ways of bringing to that frame certain political concerns that couldn't be talked about otherwise.
The song lyrics are often written by respected Indian poets and deal with issues like class struggle, domestic terrorism, and poverty. Joshi thinks Americans are likely to see more Bollywood-influenced pictures. She just hopes they also get to see some of the substance that's usually behind all that song and dance. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
And you can see some clips from Bollywood Hero at the new NPR.org.
Movie director John Hughes, who died yesterday, made films that helped teenagers define and maybe survive their high school years. Films such as 16 Candles and Pretty in Pink. One fan was so moved by his film Breakfast Club that she wrote a letter to John Hughes, and that began a pen pal relationship with him that lasted for years afterwards. Her name is Allison Byrne Field, and she joins me now from our studios in Washington. Hello.
Hello.
So what happened? You were 15 years old at the time. You'd just seen The Breakfast Club, and you wrote what was probably a typical fan letter. And what happened?
Well, I actually don't think it was all that typical of a fan letter, or maybe they were in John Hughes' world, but I really do think that I kind of spilled my guts to the guy and just told him that he had touched me as a teenager who was uncomfortable with being a teenager, uncomfortable with life in general. And so I sent it to him probably about a month later, received a form letter back from him. You are now an official member of the Breakfast Club and kind of that kind of nonsense. And I was pretty irate. I wrote back to him and, let him know that I had really spilled my guts and I didn't think a form letter was an appropriate response. And so from that point, he wrote back and apologized for having sent me a form letter.
And then you wrote back and it just continued?
Yeah, I wrote back to him and asked if he would be interested in being a pen pal on an ongoing basis. He said yes, and then we continued a correspondence for about 2 years, just, me telling him about things in my life and him telling me about his experiences. That's the story growing up. It was just about an adult who really listened to a kid and encouraged a kid.
So here's this major film director at the time. I mean, he was huge in the 80s, and he's writing to you, and you, I mean, he doesn't know you at all, really.
No, he didn't know me at all, and I think what the reasoning behind it, and, obviously I can't speak for the man, but I think what it was is that he was sincere about his desire to tell the story of young people in a way that was honest, and that having a conversation, communication with a real young person who was out there, and maybe it helped him.
It helped him in his movies?
Yeah, for him it was, he said, I make these movies for you. And so, he would laugh at the slang that I use, and he would, ask me about teachers and talk to me about my relationship with my parents. And so, I think that it did inform him, but I like to think he just also cared.
Allison, your letter writing correspondence lasted for 2 years, but then I understand you got back in touch. What happened?
Yeah. In 1997, I was working in North Carolina at a small nonprofit organization and doing work on diversity education, and I decided that I wanted to let John know what I had done with my career and what I had done in the 10 years since I had stopped writing him. And so I sent him a video about the project, and he gave me a call in the office where he just let me know that he was proud of what I had decided to do with my life. And he reminded me of how important I had been to him when he was working in Hollywood. And he talked a little bit about his decision to leave Hollywood.
Oh, what did he say about that?
He said that he left Hollywood because he felt it could potentially cause his sons to lose their perspective on what was important, and even himself to lose perspective on what was important.
And he seemed happy, and he seemed like he was glad that he had made that decision?
He seemed like it was pretty clear that it was the right decision for him, yeah.
Allison Byrne Fields lives in Washington, D.C. The details of her correspondence with director John Hughes are at her blog, and it's called willknowwhenwegetthere.blogspot.com. Allison, thank you very much.
Thank you.